Blog Talk Radio
presents a blow. Hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to Applause Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and we're back. This is we're doing a triple header. We almost had a quadruple header for tomorrow. We were going to get somebody in for Earth Day, and that didn't pan out. So, but that's great. That's great. Either way, they'll be back. So last night we had Robert Berry on. What a great guy. I love him. And tonight we have a great show. We've got some fantastic instrumental music for you guys that you're going to really enjoy from Emmy-winning composer Michael Whalen. And before we start, let me just say thanks to a few of our sponsors. Let's see. Michael's Arts and Crafts, the Hive Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's Sake, and the Observer newspaper in Kearny, New Jersey. Blah, 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 blah. I am tired tonight. Michael Whalen, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Oh, Joanne, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you again. Thank you again for coming on. I appreciate it. And, you know, we kept trying to touch base, and I profusely apologize that for the delay. I've got people coming all over lately. They want to be on the show, and it's just been overwhelming, but it's been nice, so I can't complain. So I listened to Future Shock. I really, really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to playing it for everybody tonight, too. If anybody's into instrumentation, I mean, this stuff is great. Oh, my God. I got to ask you, when you write it, are you writing it for commercials or television in mind, or you're just writing it for yourself?
Well, you know, it's one of the things that has sort of followed me through my whole career, because as a TV and film composer, I'm known for writing themes. So I've written themes for Good Morning America and Inside Edition, and I've written music for Oprah and a bunch of other people. So
right.
I love things with a really tight melody. Mm. So, you know, so this album goes kind of all over the place stylistically, but the thing that I think is the hallmark to a lot of this music is the melody.
Mm. Now your music, have you ever put in lyrics to them, or no, you just do strictly instrumentation?
Sure. I've written lots of songs with lyrics. I've written them myself, and I've also worked with some really amazing people. I've worked with Steven Sater, who did the music, did the words for Spring Awakening on Broadway. Mm. I worked with Don Black, who wrote all those iconic songs like Born Free and all those James Bond songs, whatever.
Yeah.
So I've had the opportunity to work with some really great lyricists. But the thing that I think is really interesting is when you either write an instrumental song or a vocal song, for me, the construction is the same because it's only about the melody.
Right, right. Yeah, because it's funny. I don't know if I could do it. I write music as well, but I shouldn't say write music. I write songs, you know, the melody and the lyrics. But I don't know if I could do a strictly straightforward instrumental, because whenever I get a melody, it's always with words. It's so weird. I don't know. You know what I mean? So that's why I was asking it. Yeah. So now, if for those who don't know, Michael is an Emmy-winning composer, and he has written well over 650 commercials, jingles, and I'm very interested in jingles. I have to ask you, are the jingle houses still as popular as they were in New York, like back in the 80s?
Well, the entire landscape has changed. But yes, commercial music houses are just as popular and just as busy as they ever were. The problem is, and part of it is COVID and part of it is technology, is you don't go to the music house now and do that hang that was so famous. Like, you'd go to a studio and you'd be cutting, you know, a jingle or a couple of jingles all at once, and like people would just wander in. You'd be like, hey, you know, I didn't book you for this session. Hey, but you want to go do an overdub on a thing, and we'll do a thing and whatever. And,
right.
And that doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
And, you know, and I can't tell you how often I've said, God, the community was so great. And you'd have people come in and they'd hear something and they'd be like, hey, wow, you know, I've got an idea. Well, hey, can I just try something or whatever? Or the clients would come, and the clients were always, you know, they never had any time or, you know, patience or whatever. So they would be in a situation where they'd be like, okay, well, it's 3:00. Can we have this music done like in 15 minutes? Because we have to be across town in 45 minutes for a mix.
Right. Yeah. So you can't do that right now. Yeah. I bet you would love to have been at the Brill Building back in the day.
Oh yeah. The Brill Building. And, you know, and it's funny, on the top floor of the Brill Building for a long time, there was a post-production company that I went to. I mean, seriously, Joanne, I probably went there like 400 times, and they would, like, you know, mix spots and do things, whatever. But I always wanted to, like, get off at some random floor and just sort of see if I could feel the vibe in the building, because so much stuff happened there.
Oh my God. I feel the same way. I would walk past it every day and I'd say, God, I got to get the nerve. I got to go in there. I just got to go in there. I know nothing is the same as what it was, but I wanted to see if I got that feel too. Oh, that's so crazy. That's so crazy.
And remember, on the ground floor of the Brill Building, the Colony Records was there.
Yes, yes.
And the guys who worked at Colony were like the rudest people in the world, and they knew everything. You could walk in and ask for anything. They'd be like, yeah, it's in the back corner.
Right.
Hi, the thing you want, then I see the third shelf down and the thing and the thing and the other thing and the other thing. And you'd be like, oh, my God, there it is.
I know. And you could walk in there any time of day, and there'd be a famous musician in there as well.
Right. I've done the geek thing with a few people, like at Colony and other record stores and whatever. They'd be like, hey, my name's Michael Whalen. I just wanted to say hi. With COVID and everything, I really, really miss that. And so I got vaccinated about a month ago, and I did a session way out in West Milford in New Jersey, because you're in New Jersey, so you know where that is.
Yep.
So I went and I did a session with a friend, and it was like all I could do to not hug everyone in the room.
Right. Well,
I was so happy just to be around people and to be in that kind of magical space that happens in a recording studio, where yes, you have the chart, yes, you have the format, and yes, you know what you want to do, but there's always this X factor of performance, which is so much fun.
Right. I know. But now I'm picturing you locked up in your little cave in New York and putting out Future Shock. And just, what did you work on Future Shock the whole pandemic, or was this set prior to the pandemic?
I don't want to bore you with my backstory, but like,
you're not boring me. That's why I wanted to get to know you.
Oh, thank you, darling. I appreciate that. Okay, so the pandemic has been one of the most creative periods of my life.
I think so too, right?
So last year, I released 3 records. 2 of them I recorded during the pandemic. I also did 2 major scores for movies that are going to come out later this year.
Can you tell us the movies?
All right, everyone,
can you tell us the movies?
No, I can't, or I will be killed. And the
I didn't think you could. I didn't think
right,
you could. Go ahead.
Calm,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Calm down. So, and then I had a big surgery in January. Big, major stuff. And I wasn't really thinking about doing music for an album. And then I had this crazy idea, And one thing kind of led to another in October and then November, and I'm doing his thing. And then I'm like, hey, wow, I should reach out to Simon Phillips. And Simon said, sure, I'll make some time. And then he like played drums on stuff. Then I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. So then I sent it to my friend Tony Levin, who's played on like 9 of my records. And if you guys don't know who Tony is, Tony has played with Peter Gabriel and King Crimson, and he's done sessions with everybody, including Yes and Pink Floyd and a whole bunch of other people. So with this incredible rhythm section, it's like, okay, so now what do I have? So I actually took all of their parts as they were sort of originally sketched out, and then I did a lot of editing and moving things around and manipulation or whatever. And by the time I went to the hospital for my surgery, which was January 14th this year, the record was done and mixed.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so now what do I do? I mean, and by the way, this is something that happens with creative people all the time, because it's not like we're sitting there in meetings saying, okay, well, let's go create this product for this thing. In a world of pure inspiration, you just go create stuff, and you're not necessarily thinking about how you're going to sell it.
Of course, no, it's coming out of you. It's whatever's flowing out of you. You can't just say, oh, you know, let's do this. It's whatever comes out at the time, and that's what you get.
Well, but, I mean, Joanne, you've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing this for a long time. And you and I both know people who will sit down, and they will construct their music as if it's a widget. And, like, I am literally the opposite of that.
I mean,
it never occurred to me in my wildest imagination that I would be doing some sort of jazz fusion progressive, I don't even know what to call this record. and then be like, okay, well, then how am I going to put this out and what am I going to do? And
right.
So, I mean, I think one of the things that has really changed for me is this idea that I have to, like, go land an album. So now there's 10 songs on Future Shock, and everyone has to, like, earn its stripes. It's not like the old days, like in the 80s or 90s, where you do a record and you'd be like, okay, there's 2, maybe 3 really strong tracks, and there's 6, we'll see how it goes. In environment, every single song has got to earn its right to be on that album.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you, before I forget about the jingles, now, I had a list of jingle houses back in the day, and I recall there being, I want to say I'm like 90% sure that there was a Whalen house. Was that you?
Well, there was Michael Whalen Music that was around in New York until about 98, and then I moved to Boston for a few years. And then I came back to New York right after 9/11 at the very end of 2001. And, you know, and I kind of closed up what I was doing on the jingle side because I was so busy with TV. And by the way, when you read my bio, it's interesting. So I've done, 650 isn't even close anymore. I've done probably closer to 850 TV shows, and I've probably done closer to 3,000 commercials.
Wow. Well,
so,
I said over 650.
The judge's ruling is thumbs up. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. But I mean, but there were days back in the 90s when I was doing 2 and 3, maybe sometimes 4 commercials a day.
Well, I did want to ask you did you have a problem, not you personally, but did Pepsi and Coke have a problem that you did music for them?
Or
anything? Or
This is a true story. Okay.
I want to hear it.
Positively. So in 1989, I worked for one of the biggest commercial houses in the world. So at the time it was called Elias Associates. Then it became Elias Arts, and, you know, it's been sold a couple times and whatever. And it was a great place for me to be trained, because when I got to Elias in 87, I was this 20-year-old who hadn't really done anything. And if you want to talk about baptism by fire, like, I didn't go to sleep for 2 years.
Wow.
So by 89, I was sort of a Jedi. And literally, I did a Coke final in the morning, and all the people from McCann Erickson came. And then in the afternoon, I did a Pepsi final, and all the people from BBDO came. And it was like, wow. Care that I was working on other stuff. Like, you're not going to sign me exclusively for a product. Well, I mean, if someone wants to throw seven figures at me, that would be nice. But that was actually pretty typical. Like, I would do a morning and do a Toyota commercial, and then in the evening I would do like a BMW commercial or like a GM.
Well, that's what I didn't know. Yeah, I was wondering if they had a problem with that. That you were, I mean, for you, you could write anything. So, you know, but I was wondering if they had a problem, like a conflict of interest, like, oh God, he wrote
no,
the Coke.
I mean,
I don't want him writing for us.
Well, see, because the big thing is that you're not going to tell anybody creatively what you're working on.
Mm.
So, I mean, you know, very often with an agency, you would sign an NDA, especially on a big campaign,
right,
especially like on a Super Bowl thing or whatever, and you'd be like, okay, fine, no one's going to know that I'm working on this until like after the game.
Right.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, the reason I say the Whalen House of Music, I remember the name because I submitted a jingle demo when I was like 17 years old, and I sent one to you guys. I think I did. It's so funny.
Look at you.
I can't believe it. That was a long time ago.
So you sent it when you're 17, and you sent it when you're 17, and now you're 25. So that works.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
Exactly. It just happened.
Oh,
come
stop.
On.
You got to tell me about, I'm going to get to that one in a minute. So you started out as a percussionist. How did you become a master of the synthesizer and keyboard? My God, because your music is fantastic.
It's a really interesting story. Okay, so when I was four, when I was three and a half, the first album I ever bought was Hot Buttered, where they had, you know, Hot Buttered Popcorn. Bum, 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 ba-da-bum, bum, 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 bum. Okay, so that was the very first album I ever bought, and I was in the music store with a record store with my mom, and I had to buy it because on the front cover, there was a popcorn box that you could actually put your hand down into. So I had no idea what the music was going to be like. But that album changed my life because I was like, okay, I don't know what any of these sounds are or where it came from, but that went into like deep, like, you know, into the recesses of my brain. Fast forward a year or two, I am now four and a half. I have discovered the Beatles, and I have to be Ringo Starr.
Mm.
So my parents, my mother, at the time I was growing up in Washington, D.C., so she takes me out and we buy a used drum set for like, you know, $2.28. And I put it in my bedroom. And my mother worked at home at the time. And she was literally below me. And I would be playing the drums and playing along with the records. But my mother is a saint. End of story. But
yeah.
I think two things happened. One was it was really important to me to connect to the music in the visceral way. So that's how the percussion thing started. So I got better and better. And then when I was around eight, I got my percussion teacher, a man named Tommy Wardlow, who unfortunately is no longer with us. At the time, he was the chief percussionist for the Kennedy Center.
Wow.
So in Washington, D.C. So, like, you know, American Ballet Theater and all this stuff would come in, and opera and all this stuff. And, you know, sometimes he would, like, you know, be, you know, he would, you know, work with the National Symphony and whatever. And Tommy was my teacher. When I was about 13, I was deep into mallets, marimba, xylophone, bells.
Timpani,
vibraphone, all that stuff. And so I had a really good handle on what was happening when you looked at a keyboard in that sort of Western music sort of way. And he said, Michael, listen to me. Do not be me. Do not be a guy in a pit waiting for someone to die or move on so you can move up a seat.
Mm.
What you want to do is you want to be a writer. And you have good instincts for writing. You have good instincts for, like, how things are put together. So take everything you've learned with mallets and now start applying it to the piano and keyboard. And I did. And so in that way, Tommy literally changed the course of my life because I was like, okay, drums are cruel. I'm going to be a drummer guy, and I'm going to go out on the road, and I'm going to do this stuff. He's like, do not do that. And So with that, I started playing keyboards. And now what's really funny is, like, if you ever see a video of me playing the piano, I have the worst hand position ever because no one ever taught me how to play.
Right.
So I have my hands completely, like, stretched out on the keyboard as if they're all mallets. And, like, so visually, when I look at my hands, I'm basically looking at the same way I would be looking at whether I was, like, holding, like, four mallets and playing vibraphone when I was
playing the drums.
Yeah.
Right.
So it, so that's the answer to your question. Like, so I love percussion. I think having a very strong rhythmic training and inclination makes you a better melody writer. So here's a quote. Da 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 da. Dun 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 dun. So you look at Beethoven and you look at the Fifth Symphony. The most important part of that phrase isn't necessarily the notes; it's the rhythm. You know, and you think about really great songwriters who happen to play the drums: Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters, Don Henley from the Eagles, Phil Collins from Genesis and everything else. And so these guys have such a strong rhythmic background that makes them great writers.
Right, right. And like you said, there is no percussion in it, yet there is the rhythm, you know, because it has to, like, the dun 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 dun, you know,
that's,
you know, right. What I'm saying? But yeah, I'm a big fan of the timpani. I love the timpanis. I love them.
Yep.
Love them. Love them. So what were you listening to growing up? And would you say that spending your time at the Kennedy Center kind of turned you into the orchestral / instrumental phase?
Well, okay. So I would say my entire middle school, high school, and college life was setting me up to be a commercial guy, because I was doing so many different things. So, like, I was playing an all-state symphony in Maryland. When I was 15, I spent the summer sitting in with a punk band that played all these crazy, like, festivals all over Washington, D.C. And in the 80s, Washington, D.C. was a real, like, leader in punk music.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you cross the river to the Anacostia, or, you know, go to Southeast or whatever, you know, to a black area, I was playing a keyboard at a Washington music store, and a guy walked in named Chuck Brown. Chuck Brown had a band called Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers, which is pretty much the group that invented DC go-go music. And DC go-go music is something that's based on a very distinctive shuffle rhythm. Bum, ba-bum, bum, ba-bum, bum, ba-bum, bum, ba-bum. And you'd go to a go-go, and the drummer and the percussionist, they wouldn't stop for 4 hours. People would work themselves into, like, some kind of weird, I don't know, like, hypnosis or whatever. They would just be dancing in circles for hours. And so then Chuck would, like, call a song, and we would just be like, okay, it's just on top of the same tempo, same rhythm, here we go. So I was playing the music store, and to this day, Joanne, I literally don't remember what I was playing. But he's like, that's pretty funky for a white boy. Can you play?
Yeah.
And I said, yes, sir, I can play. And he's just like, you should come play with us. I think that would be fun. So
nice.
I'm in a go-go band, pretty much the best go-go band in the history of go-go music, and I am literally the only white person. So I would play go-go's in Anacostia with my keyboard, and I would be the only white person for 20 blocks.
Music brings us all together.
But I mean, Joanna, I got to tell you, man, that experience was so great, and I learned so much. And the band was so great with me. And then we would do crazy things, like, you know, the bass player in the band, Eric, and I were really good friends. And he'd be like, you know what? You need to go to church. So he took me to this little tiny Baptist church in Southeast. And these guys, the band there, I mean, I just thinking now just makes me want to weep. The band was so good, and the vocalists were so good, and the congregation was so deep into it. You're just like, damn, if I had an opportunity to come to a place like this every Sunday, like, I would go to church. These guys killed. every Sunday. And I'm like, what is this? He's like, yeah, so you got to go to church. You know, like, and so, and then, like, I remember talking to the music director who was one of the keyboard players, and he's showing me voicings, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing this thing, and whatever. He's like, see, the way you're playing it is really weight. What you got to do is you got to put in these color notes. So I started learning about extensions, and I started learning voice leading from listening to gospel music. Yeah. So these experiences like literally changed my life, but it didn't set me up to be anything but a jack of all trades. So by the time I got to New York when I was 20, I was used to playing in lots of different styles. So when like somebody came to me with a creative brief and it was some crazy thing that I had never done before, like polka music, not kidding, or doing something less like Hawaiian music, not kidding, I'd be like, cool, all right, let's go. So my brain was already set up for it. So what's funny is now 30 years later, I'm doing solo albums, which are a little schizophrenic, like in the nicest possible way. So stylistically, you know, it's classic jazz fusion. It's progressive. You know, you're talking about maybe even like a little smooth jazz in there. Maybe you're talking about something that's like closer to R&B and you're doing something that's like lo-fi, hip-hop, whatever. And all that works for me because that's my whole background.
Right, right. So it's all, everything rolled into one with your twist on it, and that's pretty cool. Well, speaking of it, why don't we play Future Shock for everybody so they can hear it?
Well, there you go. So just a note for everybody, A, Joanne playing this is literally the world premiere in the world, so
yes.
Congratulations. And
yes,
B,
yes.
When you hear the solo and it sounds like a guitar, that's me.
All right.
So that's literally me taking a Moog synthesizer and playing it through my Marshall and a bunch of other things and then doing my thing. I love when people like Jordan Rudess does, you know, he's a keyboard player for Dream Theater. Or even if you want to go way old school, you want to talk about Frankenstein and you want to talk about like even what Keith Emerson was doing with Emerson and Palmer. He distortion was like part of his thing.
Yeah.
So this is me like, you know, totally jiving on 40 years of me just loving that sound. So there you go.
Cool. Cool. Well, everybody, as Michael said, this is the debut. What, it's releasing when, the 23rd, Mike?
Friday.
Friday, yeah, yeah. All right, this is Future Shock by Michael Whalen. Check it out. Wow, that was done. That guitar lead was done on a keyboard?
Yes, ma'am.
Wow, wow. I got to ask you, did you use an actual talk box in those parts, or was that also synthesized?
So there's sort of four pieces to what you would call the melody. So one of them is a sample of a woman's voice. Yeah. One of them is a vocal sound of a sample that I manipulated, so I can play it like a little line like that. Then there's a synth sound that's doing kind of like a chord thing, and then there's like a reverse sound that kind of takes you into the whole thing. But what's really interesting is that I didn't write or put together any of that until the bass and the drums were done.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't know if it was something on the computer or if it was an actual talk box. It sounded great. Oh, my God, it really was good. And I guess, yeah, I felt a little future shock in there. Is that why the title? Because it's a little futuresque?
Well, okay, so in 1983, Herbie Hancock did an album called Future Shock. And Herbie Hancock, if you guys know, is one of the most preeminent jazz musicians, pianists in the world. And And from that album came the single Rocket, which was a huge song in the 80s. And you had all these kids like doing like break dancing and all that stuff to it. Anyway, so Future Shock was a really important record for me because I was like, wait a second. So Herbie is not this sort of pure jazz guy. He's going to kind of go wherever he wants to go, and he's not having a conversation about style. He's having a conversation about being fully self-expressed.
Yeah. So it's an homage to Herbie Hancock, the title.
Well, I mean, the title certainly. I mean, you know, because the thing
I didn't mean the music. I meant the title only.
No, absolutely. But the thing that's really, really interesting is that, you know, I could probably talk about his album Future Shock for a lot. But he did disco music, he did straight jazz, he did Latin jazz, he did all kinds of stuff. You know, a couple of years ago, he won Album of the Year for an album that was all vocals. So he arranged all these covers, and it's so exquisite, it was so beautiful. But, I mean, so what Herbie is for me is kind of the template or like the paradigm of an artist that I would like to actually become. Now, I have done 34 solo records. I mean, Future Shock is number 34, and I've done soundtrack records, and I've done classical records, and I did like a singer-songwriter thing in 2009. And, you know, so I've done a lot of different kinds of music. So I don't rein myself in stylistically, but Future Shock was really important when I was coming up and saying, okay, this guy is not having a style conversation, but he's operating where the bar is so high in terms of performance and sort of his artistry. And so just because you're, you know, kind of playing with a style doesn't mean your performances can't be great, doesn't mean the writing can't be tight. And so, like, right off the bat, I was like, okay, even if I start playing with different styles, you know, the work has to be great. So, like, I've written two string quartets. I mean, I will tell you right now, Joanne, the specters, the ghosts of, you know, Stravinsky and Beethoven and Haydn and all these guys were looking over my shoulder when I was working on it, like, hi, is this thing that you've created worthy of being performed and recorded? That's something that's really, really important to me, because it's like, and by the way, there's no real answer to that question, but for me, does it pass my sort of, like, you know, smell test?
Right. What I wanted to ask you, what's your go-to? Is it Logic, Pro Tools, or DAW?
Oh, wow. We're gonna talk this. Okay. So my box of choice right now is Logic.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really like how it's set up. And it's really funny. When I switched from Logic, 8 years ago, I actually paid to go to a place downtown. I think it was all the way like south of Wall Street. It was really, really far downtown. And I spent an entire weekend with two guys who, calling them logic experts isn't even close to what these guys were. I mean, these guys could have coded the software, and they showed me the back of the program in 2.5 days. So nice. Spending the time, and because I'm always the guy where I get something and I sort of glance at the owner's manual and I just want to figure it out. But yeah. In this, you know, I moved from Pro Tools, and then before Pro Tools, I used a system called the Sinclair, which was very famous and very expensive and whatever. So there was a point where I had five Sinclair systems. I had four here in New York and then one in LA. I had a little satellite room. And I had never been taught how to use any of these sequencers, Fairlight or Waveframe or any of the stuff that I used through the 90s and early 2000s. So I said, look, if I am actually going to switch to something, I better be ready to make the time commitment to actually learn how it works.
Right, right. Well, I've got two questions for you. The first one, oh, God, I lost the first one. I know I had it right on the tip of my tongue. All right. I'm sorry. I don't write my questions down. Sorry, honey. I'll give you the second one. Are you loving the fact of what kind of music we can make now on a computer? I remember the question. Let me get this out before I forget. which audio tools do you find would be the most easiest for someone who is just wanting to learn or start? What program?
Well, the fast answer is GarageBand.
Yeah.
So if you are just like a brand new person and you want a digital audio workstation and you buy a Mac, it's already installed.
Mm.
So any GarageBand sequence or session that you do can be up converted to a Logic session.
Right.
So, and which I have done a bunch of times, which is great.
Right.
But even somebody like Fiona Apple, who just won 2 Grammys this year and is probably one of the greatest singer-songwriters in history of anything,
mm-hmm.
she records, I would say, about 90% of what she does at home, and she does it all on GarageBand.
Wow, wow. Wow. And the second question, which I asked first, but how are you loving all the technology that you can make such amazing music now and by yourself? You don't need a band to do it now, you know? Like, how do you like that a lot?
I like it and I don't. So, I mean, could I have done Future Shock without calling live musicians? Technically, yes.
Yes.
But there is something to be said for what a great player brings to a part that is way beyond the notes. Even, I mean, frankly, even beyond my intention.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about this, I'm like, okay. I mean, I had no idea what the bass on this album was going to sound like. And I got Tony's parts back and I was like, you're kidding.
Mm.
Like the thing he was doing in the fills and the slides and the things and the whatever. And then he was doing like these little transition phrases. And you're just like, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. So, I did an album last year called Sacred Spaces, which was really popular. It was all over the place. I think I probably did 300 interviews about it. It charted all over the place. It was great. And I did the whole thing myself. And
nice.
Then I did an album actually when I was like pretty much recovering from COVID with just me and a flute player, this guy, Blue Monk, who lives in Malaysia. It was a really fun project. And that really opened the door to saying, okay, well, let's see what I can do if I did a whole band. And
nice.
I always wanted to work with Simon Phillips. Simon Phillips is a very famous English drummer who lives in L.A. He's played with Toto and The Who and Pink Floyd, and I mean, his Jeff Beck. I mean, he's played with so many people.
Right.
And I always wanted to work with him. He has a fusion group of his own called Prototype, which is just wonderful. I mean, the band is fantastic and they're super tight. And he does all the mixing and the engineering himself. The records sound great. And so I knew if I called Simon, he would bring something completely different to the album than I could program on a computer.
Mm.
So yes, I could probably have done it, but I don't think you can. There's an X factor for the human performance thing that I don't think a computer will ever be able to get.
I agree on that. I'm speaking of Fiona Apple earlier. You got to tell me about Tiny Hands. How'd that come about?
Okay, so the quick version of the story is that Fiona Apple and my wife are best friends.
Oh, cool.
Like best friends. So my wife was going to march in the Women's March with Gloria Steinem and a whole like little pod of people.
Yeah.
And my wife invited Fiona to go, and she couldn't make it. So she recorded a chant that she wanted all the women to do at the event, you know?
Right.
So she recorded this chant, and I was like, this is so cool. Text it to me. So I took the chant, and I created a track to it, and I texted to Fiona, and I said, what do you think? And she's like, oh, my God, this is great. You should post it. And I'm like, I can't post it. You're Fiona Apple. No, it'd be great. Just put it on a thing and whatever. And she has a very scary manager, a guy named Andy Slater. And I was like, look, Andy's going to come and he's going to cut my throat and it's going to be terrible. No, really, it'll be fine. Okay. So I took her chant. And by the way, guys, it's on SoundCloud. It's called Little Hands. It's pretty much at the top of my page. It's easy to find. So I posted on SoundCloud, and within, I don't even think it was 20 minutes. It was on the front page of Consequences Found. And within 24 hours, it was in the New York Times, it was in Vogue, it was in Rolling Stone, it was everywhere. And like, you know, I was getting called and interviewed and whatever, and like, how did this all happen and whatever. And this was back in 2017. Right before Trump was inaugurated, and you know we don't want your tiny hands anywhere near our underwear, and it became a thing. And then for the right. Women's March, you know, everyone was wearing signs and people were wearing underwear with hands on it. It was unbelievable, and so it was a really fun thing to do, but unless you are actually ready for something that you do to go viral, it's totally dislocating. It's like, oh my God, what has just happened? And so before you even know it, there was a 500,000 plays of it, and it was all over the world.
Right. Oh man. Well, you have such a wide array and variety of talent here. I mean, my God, you could write anything. You really could. And I liked Morning Song a lot. Do you mind if I play that?
Morning Song is great. Now, so Morning Song has a very interesting backstory, which is that's a melody that I have been playing with for decades. And my joke about it was, if Good Morning America ever called me back and said, hey, you wrote this theme and we used it for 6 years, hey, can you write us another one? It would have been the Morning Song theme. So when you guys listen to it, remember, A, I have, you know, won Emmys for my TV music, and B, I love tight melodies and I love little structures like this. So this was a really fun song to do.
Cool. This is, well, before I play it, I did want to ask you, are they still playing your song on Good Morning America?
Not the theme, but it's funny. Every once in a while, they'll pull out like something and they'll create a bumper out of it or whatever. And so, you know, It's fun when you create something and it has such a half-life. Like here in New York, we have this thing called New York One News. I did the original package, and 23 years later, they're still using pieces of it. It's
wow.
It's fun. It's great.
Cool. Well, here we go. This is Morning Song, Michael Whalen from his new album, Future Shock. Check it out. I needed that. Thank you. That was so nice. Those are live horns and brass and everything, right?
Right. So,
yeah, I could tell.
Did the sax, and Bob is one of the best players in the country. And it's just what's really cool is you write a melody and you go, wow, it's a really nice melody. But when you hear it performed, everything changes. So, I mean, you know, Bob puts so much passion, and he's a crazy perfectionist, and, you know, and he'll send me something, and 2 minutes later, he'll call me and be like, hey, I sent the thing, what do you think? I'm like, I haven't even had time to download it, dude. I haven't even put it in the session yet. Give me a second. I mean, he is a wonderful collaborator and somebody who gets so excited about the process. So I'm very lucky.
Now, let me ask you this. Now, this is an album that you've written for yourself, obviously. Now, would you submit these songs to advertisers or to television or movies right now, or no, this is strictly for you?
Oh, no. I mean, I would love if, you know, somebody in television, you know, picked up, you know, this and turned it into a theme for something. I think that would be great. But, you know, there's sort of three spaces for me. One is I create what I'm creating as an absolute. Then I am listener number one, which is this music something that I want to spend my time listening to. And I don't care if anyone else does.
Right.
And then the third space is letting it go into the world and to the people who like my music and people who don't like my music and everything else. And you get all of that stuff. Whatever they say about the music is just as valid as my original intention.
Right. You're writing it for you. And if people love it, that's great, you know.
Yeah.
And if somebody picks it up, that's even better. So I have to ask, are you still teaching? I see you've been all over the place. And are you teaching all at the same time as all these places, the City College of New York, the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music, NYU? Are you still there? Are these all happening at once?
My day job is that I am the general manager and the head of A&R for a company called Mindstream, MYNDSTREAM. Yeah. So what Mindstream is a lifestyle brand, and we create music for lifestyle. And some people would say, well, you know, it's new age and it's ambient and it's this and it's that. Okay. So long story short, they're based in LA, I'm in New York, and our headquarters is in London, so I get emails from everyone all the time. So my job is to basically wrangle our 40 artists or so and make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do and then run the company. And on top of it, I have all the other stuff that I do as a composer. So I never thought I was going to become a record executive. You know, it's even funny for me to say that. And at the same time, I am somebody who is deeply, deeply, deeply committed to empowering people, because as a teacher, because I've taught at Berkeley in Boston, I've taught at the City College of New York, I've taught at NYU, I've taught at the New School. But at this point, what I'm doing now is I'm working inside the industry. Occasionally, an artist will come to me and say, hey, can you work with me on marketing? Can you consult with me on the release that I have? And I'll find time to do that. But I love teaching at City College. That was so much fun. I love my students, and so many of them have done so well. One of my students is a guy named Andy Mineo, who is really one of the top pop hip hop recording artists in the world at this point. And he was one of my students at City College. And I remember seeing his first record deal, and I took him out to lunch and we talked about the whole thing before he had a manager. Mentoring young people is a gift, and it's a wonderful privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you've got so much to offer these kids, and you know, your talent is just amazing. I mean, I love the stuff. I love it. I needed it tonight too. I needed some instrumental tonight, you know,
Yeah.
So tell everybody, where they can, get the new album and when it's dropping, what's happening. Tell everybody.
All right. So Future Shock will be everywhere you can listen or stream or buy music on Friday. So like, if you're a Spotify person or an Apple Music person or an Amazon person or the other 250 platforms, it will be available everywhere in the world on Friday. And then on Monday next week, I'm going to do a live streaming event where I'm going to have conversations with Bob and Simon, who worked on the record with me, and it's going to be really, really great. So if you go to my Facebook page, Michael Whalen Music, the links for everything will be there, and you can come and see me and hear me on Monday.
That's how I found you, on Facebook, and I'm so glad I did. Michael, oh my God, it was a pleasure speaking with you. I cannot believe everything you talked about in your life. We was just so so much in common with mine, but you were able to take it to a whole nother level, which is I'm jealous. I'll be quite honest.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to somebody who loves music so much. Because,
oh, I
you know,
do.
You,
I love it.
You know, because it's funny, you talk about music with people and, you know, sometimes you feel like you're talking to a robot and you're just so filled with love and committed to great music. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, please. Thank you. It was a pleasure. I'm so glad I got to know you. Now I know I can go use GarageBand for myself because I'm an idiot when
totally.
It comes to the computer. And, you know, it's been a while since I've put anything down. And lately, with all the guests I've been getting on, I'm getting inspired again, you know. So so we'll see if
That's
time
great.
Permits. We'll see if time permits. But I just wanted to say, again, thank you. I'm going to close out with the, which one? Polyjam. I'm going to close out with that one. You want to give us a little story behind that before I play it?
Sure. So Polyjam is deeply inspired by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. So if you guys are prog music people, you might hear like a little reference to Tarkus. You might hear like a little, I don't know what. But it was a really, really, really fun song to do. The guys love playing it. So Polyjam.
Yeah, you know, we had last night, do you know Robert Berry?
I know his name. I do not know Robert.
Yeah, well, he actually played with Keith and Carl. They yep. had a band called Three.
That's right.
And he's got a new album out, Third Dimension. And he's got a song on there that he did with Keith Emerson prior to his passing. Maybe I've got my finger quotes here that maybe it was Keith's last work before he passed.
Wow.
Yeah, we weren't able to play it. It was a 9-minute song, and the platform doesn't allow for it. Only allows 100 gigs or whatever, MGs, whatever that means. You know, I don't know what an MG is. So megabyte.
Dude.
Yeah, so I told you I'm a computer idiot. I won't lie. I don't know. Maybe if I knew, I'd be a little closer somewhere. But everybody, thank you so much. Michael Whalen on the phone with us tonight. I can't thank you enough. His new album, Future Shock, coming out on the 23rd. Wherever you can get music online, that's where you're going to find it. And you're going to really enjoy it. And here is Polyjam. And thank you, Michael. A pleasure. And I hope we get to talk again.
Thanks so much, Joanne. Thanks so much.
Take care. Listen up if you want to listen in, okay? Take care. This is Polyjam, Michael Whalen, from his new album, Future Shock. Thank you, Michael. Take care, everybody. We'll see you on Wednesday for the Vinnie Mark and his wife, Jody Mark. We're doing somewhat of a telethon, trying to help raise some money for a gentleman and his wife who are going through cancer. They're from the comedian circuit and the comedy circuit, pardon me, and just a wonderful family of friends, and they're there to support Vinnie Mark. And they're each going to do a 10-minute set of stand-up on the show. And I hope you guys enjoy it. So thank you again, Michael. Michael Whalen, everybody. Check out his new album, Future Shock, coming out on the 23rd of April. Go check it out. Michael, take care. Thank you so much. Bye-bye, everybody.